This is First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. First Draft highlights the voices of writers as they discuss their work, their craft, and the literary arts. My guest is Rachel Cantor. Her novels include A Highly Unlikely Scenario and Good on Paper. Cantor has lived and worked all over the world, including Azerbaijan, Zimbabwe, Laos, and Senegal. She spent her adolescence in Rome and Massachusetts. Her latest novel, Good on Paper, tells the story of Shira Green, a single mother co-parenting her daughter with her best friend, Ahmad. She is struggling in various temp jobs and then gets a call to translate a Nobel Prize-winning poet's work from Italian to English. In the process, she discovers translation may be impossible. We began the interview discussing the title, Good on Paper.
Well, the title of the book is the title of one of the chapters, and actually it's not our original title. It's not even my original title. I had a lot of titles before settling on this one. The title that I presented to my publisher, which is Melville House, was Door Number 2, which I quite liked at the time, but which reminded me that maybe the majority of my reading public might not even know what that referred to. So together we came up with Good on Paper, which I quite like and which has gotten a very nice response because it has meaning, I think, on several levels. There's the obvious idea of something being good on paper, or something that can be good on paper, which we assume is good and right, and yet there's an implied disconnect between what is good on paper and what's actually good in life, I guess. And this is not just the men we fall in love with, though, maybe particularly the men we fall in love with, but also the jobs we take that we think are going to change everything, or the plans we have for our future, or even our feelings about the lives we live right now. So that disconnect is implied in the title, and it's a dimension of the book. But there's also this very kind of, on a very literal level, there's this idea that so much of the book is concerned with paper. Shira's dreams and her understandings of what she wants for herself and her family, they're all on paper. It's not just a metaphor. It's actually literal. You know, she starts with a terrible temp job, folding and filing papers, which mean nothing to her. And then she gets a telegram, which is a piece of paper, which changes everything. And she's a translator, so the pages that she receives from the poet whose work she's translating come into her on paper. There's the books that she loves reading. There's the bookstore, which is filled with books, which is owned by the love interest. His name is Benny. There's his literary magazine, in which her stories have appeared. There's even her daughter even writes short stories and reads books. So this book is full of paper, and paper has meaning. Paper has meaning for people like you and me and possibly the people who are listening to this broadcast. Paper has a lot of meaning, and so it has that resonance, the added resonance in the book, I hope.
So you mentioned, you know, for listeners who haven't read it, there's kind of a few main characters. The main character is Shira, and she is a single mom with a daughter, and she lives with a friend, Ahmed, but they're co-parenting the daughter, but he's not the biological father.
No.
And Shira's trying to get her life together as a mom, as a worker, her love life. So tell me about the creation of her and how, I know you were doing these collected short stories about her, but what about her personality? What questions did you have about this person that you wanted to explore on the page?
That's a really good question. And, you know, it gets straight to the heart of the book because, well, of course, Shira is at the center of the book, but the inspiration for Shira comes straight to the heart of the book as well. And the inspiration is a little bit obscure. I had attended a workshop in, I think it was now 1997 or 8, on the Song of Songs with a wonderful rabbi. His name is Reb Zalman Shachter Shalomi. And he taught the Song of Songs, and I read it in his, you know, under his tutelage for the very first time, and was very stunned by it. He encouraged us to read that poem, which probably everyone knows is a love poem, and it appears in the Bible. And it's very often, traditionally, it's read as an allegory for God's love of Israel or God's love of the church, depending on which direction you come at the poem from. he encouraged us to also read it as a poem about an actual pair of lovers who treat each other with enormous respect and care and love, and then that includes the woman as well. She has a very active role in her love affair, and it's a very beautiful, sensual story about, well, story. It's a very, very beautiful poem about how they have a sacred love for each other, or how they make their relationship sacred through respect and care and physical closeness and so on. And the story just really, the poem really moved me a lot. It really was a poem about how a person can be both innocent and passionate at the same time. And I had recently written a story about an unnamed character, one of the stories that was to appear and eventually appear in this short story collection, but an unnamed character at this point was kind of not fully formed yet, but something about the Shulamite in the poem, the Song of Songs, just reminded me of Shira when she was a teenager, which is when the story takes place. And I named her Shira. Shira is means song. It's from the Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim. So she came from this idea that you can be loving and passionate, but also innocent at the same time. And how can that coexist in one person? That's sort of a major question for this novel. And that was the very original inspiration for her. And from that came a lot of stories, starting from when she was maybe 15, but also looking back to some disruptive experiences when she was younger, and then casting forward till she was a mother and living with Ahmad and having a lot of romantic difficulties. And all the stories predate the novel. And some of them end, the last story ends just before before the novel begins. Because actually, Good on Paper was meant to be the final story in that short story collection. It started out, I intended it to be a story, and was very excited to have the idea that I might soon be finishing this collection and have a book to show for myself just a few years out of graduate school. And then I was at a residency and had a lot of time, had about 7 weeks, and the story just kept growing and growing and growing. And soon it was a novella, and by the time I left, it was very clear that I was writing a novel and would not be finishing that short story collection, at least not at that moment. But Shira has there's a lot to her, and she had enough, there was enough to her and the idea of her and her history to fill a novel as well as a lot of short stories.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Do you think that it was because you had these 8 weeks at McDowell to write this, and this was the one you were working on? Or do you think it was because Shira at the age of 40 was the most interesting?
I'll maybe never know. I really had hoped to write the short story, but even in its original conception, it was probably too large to be a short story. But I was a pretty inexperienced writer, and I didn't know that yet. I had just written a bunch of short stories, and I didn't really know what a novel would feel like when it presented itself. And this idea was definitely too large to be a short story. But I did give it all my best try to make it short. But I think the idea that I was at a residency for 7 weeks, which then got extended to 8 weeks, which, by the way, is the longest period of most extended period of writing time I've had in my entire life since or before. I think having that extended period of time did allow it to become what it had to be. And it's possible that under different circumstances, I might have truncated it somehow or gone a different direction just to be able to finish it. And I might have chosen a simpler idea to get where I had to go. So it's hard to know. I think it's a combination of both. I think the story had heft, but the fact that I was at that residency and had this incredibly expansive time and space made the novel possible in really practical terms.
You're listening to First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. My guest is Rachel Cantor, author of the novel Good on Paper. So let's talk about Shira's specific plight in your novel. She has Andy, who's five?
She's seven at the start of the book, yeah.
Seven. And she's in a bad temp job. She is a translator. She had some renown when she was in grad school, but hasn't really done it a while in Italian. And she gets this fax that this poet from Italy, who's Nobel Prize winning, wants her to translate his work. So tell me about this predicament and how you came to that, and what did you, what were you trying to think about?
Well, as a point of clarification, I think she probably was never really had much renown, not even in grad school. And I think her relationship with translation was so uneasy that, you know, in the end, it became easier for her not to translate. She kind of distrusted. She had a very uneasy relationship with the whole idea of communicating with other people, with creating intimacy with other people, and both in terms of translation, but actually in terms of her life as well. So she's a very underachieving translator, and this makes it all the more stunning that she gets a call from this Nobel Prize winning poet. He gives her a plausible reason. It's related to a work that she had done when she was in grad school, and his work will have a relationship to that work, which is an early work of Dante called Vita Nuova. And this sounds more or less plausible to her. And so she takes on the work, and she's very excited about it. But, you know, it's good on paper, but in fact, it turns out to be a whole lot more complicated than that. And she begins to realize, as he begins sending her pieces of the work, and I won't give too much away, but she begins to realize that he must have some other agenda, because this is not a straightforward translation assignment, and she knows enough to know that. And she's got to kind of navigate what that means, and it evolves. Her understanding of what he's doing evolves, and starts to really challenge her. It starts to challenge everything that she believes about translation, believes about herself, believes about her future and her past, and as that happens, her family relationships suffer, and she's got pressure on all sides.
I'm curious, as you've probably talked about this a lot, about the notion of translation. Yeah. At one point, she says, you have a whole chapter, and it's written in Italian, but it means translation or traitor, or translator or traitor.
Translator, traitor, yeah.
So we're talking about one language going into another language. And I think it's so fascinating that different individuals translating works could come up with something so different, especially when you have just an elementary understanding of a language like Spanish 101 and you say car and it's coche. And it doesn't seem like that's hard to translate, but it gets so much more complicated.
It does. I have enormous respect for translators, and hoped through the book. I mean, this wasn't my purpose in writing the book, but in the writing of the book, I hope to convey something of the complexity and the difficulty of what translators do, because it's enormously difficult. I mean, there's every aspect of language which, you know, you or I as writers or readers pay attention to in our native language has to be an object of concern for the translator. And there's no way that you can be 100% faithful to that original document, because if you're translating the rhymes, you're going to necessarily, well, most likely, lose something of the sense. And if you make sure that the rhythm is okay, or you're going to lose something of the length of the line. It just goes on, and it's especially complicated with poetry, of course, because of all the various constrictions that especially formal poetry that of the original. So she had to be very actively translating as a real piece of work in the book. I want that to have a real presence, but it's also clear that, you know, it has a sort of a metaphorical meaning, or it has a deeper meaning for her. And the carrying over of meaning from one language to another is something she just trusts because she doesn't trust intimacy. And that sort of process involves a lot of very careful listening and attentiveness and openness and a sense of kind of a vulnerability as you allow, this is, I imagine, as you allow the author's words to become your own. And this is something that Shira, in her heart of hearts, can't really believe in because of her personal history and her fears and so on. She can't really believe in that meaningful connection. So while translation, I hope, has a kind of a real presence in the book as an action that she undergoes in her work, it also has a deeper meaning, and it reflects her own fears and limitations and concerns and the things that trouble her and that she has to work around and that challenge her in this book.
Well, what we're talking about here is kind of literal translation from one language to another. But I think writing a novel is all about translation from ideas to the page. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that in your process?
Mm. Well, I tend to write starting from a character and then rather than starting from an idea. And I know that sounds unlikely now that you've read the book and it seems to have a fair number of ideas in it. But really, I saw that there was a problem that I needed to address in this book, and I needed to move Shira and her character as it stood at the beginning of that book, which is to say at the end of the stories, and move her from point A to point Z, and had an idea of where she needed to be at the end. And how do you affect that transformation through narrative? And that was the problem. I mean, that was the problem I needed to solve. It didn't feel so much like a translation of an idea so much as a kind of a grinding it out on the page and organically evolving something that would solve that problem, which also meant lots and lots and lots and lots of revision. I did borrow a structure which helped with that, but even that was, well, it had sort of an idea behind it, which is the hero's journey, so that there's a 7-part structure to the book that follows the basic moments of a hero's journey from call all the way to something like redemption or the journey home. And that helped me structure the book. But even that wasn't so much of an idea as it was a series of guideposts that would help me get from one point to the end. So that I think that, you know, the idea of translation, for example, and we keep returning to that, it was something she was already doing before the book began. And I saw that as an opportunity. I saw that as offering rich possibilities for her to play out what needed to be played out so that this transformation could take place. I'm not sure it really was a question of ideas translating into story so much as character playing out the drama of her transformation.
You're listening to First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. My guest is Rachel Cantor, author of the novel Good on Paper. Part of the search for the self for Shira is forgiveness. And you open up the book with a poem by Galway Connell, and it's talking about how we have to learn that rising from the ashes is really about being the flames. So tell me about that idea.
Oh, I just love that piece. It connects very much with the very end of the book. I can even read the epigraph if you like. It's very short.
Please.
Okay. It's a small section of a poem called Another Night in the Ruins from the book Body Rags. And again, it's Galway Connell. How many nights must it take one such as me to learn that we aren't, after all, made from that bird which flies out of its ashes, that for a man as he goes up in flames, his one work is to open himself, to be the flames. And I love that. I love the images. The images also connect with various images in the book. There's birds, there are flames in the book even. So that it spoke to me of the theme of the book, which, as you say, is really about forgiveness and how do you open yourself to another person to enough to be able to forgive wrongs that were done you, and how do you do it if that person doesn't ask for forgiveness? You know, so the book embodies or comes up in various ways lots of different aspects of forgiveness. You know, how do you ask for forgiveness in a way that can be accepted by another person? In the end, how do you forgive? How do you forgive if someone doesn't do the work of asking for forgiveness? If they don't admit that they've done wrong? If they don't say they're sorry? If they don't make amends? You know, what do you do? How do you live with that, and how do you move beyond it in a way that allows you to have meaningful relationships in the case of Shira? And this is the work she has to do in the novel. She has to figure this out. And I won't say any more about whether she does or not. But it's hard work, and it involves opening, and it involves being willing to be hurt, you know, being willing to be the flame, to kind of be consumed yourself in order to accept the brokenness of another person, and probably also your own brokenness, so that you can love again. And that's in a nutshell, or very large nutshell, what the book is really kind of at its deepest level, I think, about.
Well, let's talk about some of your influences. Can you read a passage from an author that speaks to you as a writer?
Yeah, I thought long and hard about what influence is, and I find it very hard to trace specific influences in terms of, you know, this book or that book. But the book that came to mind, and I know you're going to laugh at me, as really actually having an effect on the writing I do, on the sentences that I write, was Strunk and White's Elements of Style. And there's a passage in there which I read when I was in high school, which was a very long time ago, and it has stuck with me ever since. It has influenced everything I've written ever since. And it's about concision. So it's only a few sentences long. And probably you've read it too at some point. Vigorous writing is concise. A sentence should contain no unnecessary words, a paragraph no unnecessary sentences. For the same reason that a drawing should have no unnecessary lines and a machine no unnecessary parts. This requires not that the writer make all his sentences short, or that he avoid all detail and treat his subjects only in outline, but that every word tell. And again, I read this book in high school, which was decades ago, but it influenced everything I wrote ever since. And I guess I take pride in writing sentences that don't contain unnecessary words, where every word tells. And it's thanks to William Strunk Jr. and E.B. White and their Elements of Style.
Does that happen for you in the first draft? Like, are you the type of writer where you'll go over a sentence again and again and again before you move on, or do you do that later?
I write fairly fluently when I have a sense of what I want to write, and I don't mean that in a very programmatic sense of first this, then this, then this. But if I have a sense of a mood, or I have a sense of an action that needs to take place, or a sense of what the character is feeling at that moment, if I'm really fully present with that — it sounds a bit mystical — but if I'm really fully present with what needs to happen, I write fairly fluently, and my sentences generally please me. It's really at the structural level, or the level of, as you're saying, kind of distributing secrets, if you want to look at it that way, or affecting that transformation from point A to point Z, where I have to go back and think, well, you know, that scene doesn't contribute to this transformation the way I'd like it to, and maybe I need a different scene, or the revision is much more likely to concern itself with structure and plot than it is with sentences. The sentences, because the book, my writing is so voice-driven, the voice is in my head, and it comes out, and for the most part, it's not in need of a lot of editing. Although that's the first thing I will do is cut out words that don't need to be there. That's a reflexive action at this point.
How about if you can read something that you wrote, maybe something that changed a lot from the first draft, or something that you really like?
I'm going to read the very opening page, because I rewrote the opening so many times, and I'll read you the first page, and I even made note of some earlier first lines, and I can read those as well, so you can see how differently it's changed over the years. This is the very beginning of Good on Paper. 12,000 envelopes wanted stuffing. There were 12,000 labels to affix. Mr. Ferguson, administrative manager of Legs Are Us, had particular ideas about proportional folding and straight affixion. Affliction, Darlene asked. Affixion, I said. Never heard of that, Darlene said. Exactly, I said. Why are you whispering, Darlene asked. I was hiding in the supply closet, but Darlene didn't need to know that. You need to airlift me out of here, I said. You need to stick it out, Shira. I can't keep placing you if you keep quitting jobs. I never managed to stick. I couldn't look at the walls of the schlock gallery. I couldn't bear the boss who kept telling me to smile, or the funny smell in the church office lunchroom. I blamed Clyde. We'd gotten together last spring as the Good Sense Flavor Factory prepared for Winter Wonderland. As a joke, the flavor text to a holiday party, complete with an inflatable Santa and a menorah for me and the ancient receptionist. So that's the opening as it now stands. It was hard for me to write. I had so many openings that were all flawed for many reasons. I think I knew what the book was about, so it wasn't that I needed to finish the book in order to write the beginning that belonged with the book. I just think that before I could get it right, I needed to know more about storytelling. So this first chapter now, as it stands, while just being 3 pages long, does a lot of work. It introduces Shira's ground situation and her most important conflicts, not just in this what I read, but the few pages that follow. And also we'll introduce her family, we'll introduce Ahmad and Andy, her daughter, and tell us important things we need to know about them, and also something about Shira's relationship with them. So the first chapter now works very hard, and earlier versions were much less satisfactory.
Where do you write?
You know, I live in a very small New York City apartment, so I have a little space in my apartment set aside for my office, but most often I work on my couch, unless I'm very lucky and I can go to a writer's colony, which is where I've written, which is where I wrote a lot of Good on Paper and a lot of other work as well.
And what do you do, or where do you go to get away from writing?
I just walk out my front door. I live in New York City. I am passionately in love with this city, and every time I walk outside, it's like life begins all over again. I have wonderful things to look at and to taste and to smell and to experience, and literally I only have to walk out my door and everything is new again.
And who do you show your work to first to get feedback?
You know, it depends on the book. I don't have one person, and I don't have a writing group. This book went to a few different readers, mostly readers. Two of them were writers of sort of more or less realist fiction. One was an old family friend. He was actually the very first person to see the book, and I gave it to him because I knew he would love me, even if it turned out I didn't know how to write a book. And my sister also read it because she's a good reader, and I wanted sort of a layperson's opinion. But other books have other readers. It really does depend on the sensibility of the book and who I think will be a good open mind for the book.
And how have you dealt with rejection?
You know, trial and error, I guess. I think, you know, in the beginning you send out stories to literary magazines and you are crushed when they're rejected. And then you learn to be less crushed. Maybe it's just the accumulation of experience makes you less soft or less porous when it comes to that. And one of the things I did was I would always have an idea of where I would send a story out next. You know, once it got rejected, I would send a story out next. But then there was always something else that would be hard. So you get used to literary magazines rejecting you, and then it becomes the residencies or it becomes the prizes. And I think another thing I did is to really talk myself into believing how much of a arbitrary process it can be, or how subjective the process of judging can be, and to try to believe it, and to remind myself that my work really isn't for everybody, and it's not for everybody, especially when they're having a bad day or you never kind of know what's going on in the mind of somebody who's saying yes or no, and that helps. So I mean, over the years, I think I've become more thick-skinned. Most rejection really truly doesn't bother me anymore. I think that's basically true. Yeah, I'm disappointed when I don't get $20,000 grants, but you know, that's something you learn to live with.
What is your favorite word?
I thought about this long and hard, and every time I thought about it, another word popped into my mind. And the word that popped into my mind just before we started our interview was actually an Italian word, and I have no idea why it popped into my mind. But it's zucchero, which means sugar. And I love the sound of the word. I love the verb of the word, zucchero. It's just zucchero. I like it so much.
You've been listening to First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. My guest is Rachel Cantor, author of the novel Good on Paper. You can follow First Draft on Facebook. Just look for First Draft, a dialogue on writing and click like, and on Twitter at First Draft APR. You can email me at firstdraftwriters@gmail.com. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. Thanks for listening.